The war epic 1917 startled a lot of awards watchers Sunday night when it won the Golden Globe for Best Dramatic Film. That's in part because it's just now going into wide release.
1917 is directed by Sam Mendes and follows two young World War I soldiers who are sent on a dangerous mission to deliver a crucial message. And just to increase the level of difficulty a little bit, the whole movie is crafted to look like one continuous shot. I'm Stephen Thompson.
And I'm Linda Holmes. We're talking about the movie 1917 on this episode of Pop Culture Happy Hour from NPR. Here with me and Stephen in the studio is Glenn Weldon of NPR's Arts Desk. Hi, Glenn.
Hey, Linda.
And in our fourth chair, we're always delighted to welcome NPR film critic Bob Mondello. Hi,
so
Bob.
So good to be here.
Delighted. Happy 2020, Bob.
Oh, yeah. We're all going to be seeing clearly this
Absolutely.
Year.
Welcome, welcome. So I want to ask Glenn first, how did you feel kind of going into this film? What were your expectations? How did it meet them?
Yeah, okay. If I worked at the Universal Pictures marketing department, they're the distributors of this film, here's what I would put on every single poster. 1917, not just a dad movie.
Yeah.
Or maybe not the dad movie you think it is, because it's clearly a dad movie. I mean, make no mistake, he's going to love it. When you call home every Sunday and before he hands you over to your mom and after he asks you how your car's running, if you engage him on this film, he's just going to go off. It's his movie, but it's also kind of my movie. It is a very exciting, very tense, frequently gorgeous, well-acted, including by both its two leads and by the cameos, as you mentioned, by the six British actors whose names you know. I mean, all of them. I expected Helen Mirren to turn up any minute as an American doughboy.
Yep.
Where you went over the top. She could do it. But, and it's certainly, we're going to spend some time talking about this. As a technical accomplishment, it is fantastic. It is unabashedly a genre movie, specifically a World War I movie with all the trappings that entails, including like a go back home, like that. All that stuff is in it because it couldn't not be. But here's what it's not, at least for me. It's not brutal and gritty and punishingly realistic. It's not Saving Private Ryan. It starts out that way. But for me, as it goes on, it becomes less effective because it starts throwing at its characters things that no human could survive, could endure. Physics and physiology go a little bit feathery at the edges as the film goes on. That keeps you gobbling your popcorn. That keeps it exciting. That keeps it tense. But it also kind of, I just didn't buy some of what was happening. But I came away from this film really impressed that it wasn't the film I thought it was going to be. And I think a lot of people, I don't think I'm going to be alone in that conclusion.
Yeah. I want to step back a second and just say the leads that Glenn mentioned are George MacKay and Dean Charles Chapman, who you might know from Game of Thrones.
Mm-hmm.
Very early Game of
very
Thrones.
Early.
Overwhelmingly, the film is on the shoulders of the two leads.
Mm-hmm.
It's appreciated best as a two-character piece. Bob, how did this land for you?
Well, the technical effects of it, I was blown away. I'd heard ahead of time that Roger Deakins and Sam Mendes had been talking about doing this as if it were one shot. And, you know, they don't really make a pretense that it is one shot.
Right.
They keep giving you moments where you think, okay, they just went into a dark place. It went completely black for a second. That
right.
must be where everybody reset. But as a practical matter, you know, once they're in the trenches, for instance, initially at least, you're thinking, okay, now, the camera's in front of them. How is it going to get someplace else? There's no place to go in a trench. And then they'll hit something and it'll jog around them somehow. And
mm-hmm.
and you just think, okay, I get it now. And then at some point it goes higher. And I was so overwhelmed by what they could do for the first half hour that I wasn't really paying attention to the stuff that Glenn says was
mm-hmm.
completely plausible. Now, when it got implausible, I started to get scared for them in the course of the movie. And, you know, like at that point, the tension of the film took over for me. And I forgot about the technique, except in a couple of places where I realized, you know, like I'm staring at something and, oh, my God, there's this guy over there with a gun. And I hadn't noticed him and they hadn't either. And it was like, ah! So I'm doing that through the whole movie. I think it's an incredibly effective film. And I didn't actually question most of the things that Glenn's saying about the second half. Physics, yeah, I hear you.
It has a little bit of a case of it's a good thing everyone chasing you is a terrible shot, which is very common in
Stormtroopers,
very common in war movies and sometimes other movies, action
right.
movies. Stephen, have this one go for you.
Yeah, I had basically the same reaction you guys did. I mean, it's interesting. Going into this film, we had a lot of of conversations internally about you have to see it on a big screen. Like, go and experience the grandeur of the technical accomplishment of the, you know, cinematography. And I think that's true. And I think that it is, I think, best served by a big screen. But at the same time, this isn't Dunkirk. This isn't, a rich blue palette with, you know, derring do in aerial battles. This is ground level, grunt level, what's in front of your face, wading through the corpse bog kind of war movie. And it's not necessarily gory, but it is visceral. It is like you are sloshing through bodies.
Yeah.
And that is a very intense experience. I found this movie riveting and beautiful, and as you guys mentioned, very, very well acted, even as so much of what's going on doesn't necessarily lend itself to sitting around doing lots of acty reflection.
Mm-hmm.
George MacKay in particular does an enormous amount of acting with his eyes in ways that I found really impressive. I love this movie.
And don't forget that Sam Mendes comes from theater, and that explains why this notion of doing it all in one take, kind of, or being able to go for 20 minutes without a cut, makes good sense for him. It's not a big deal. You ask the actor to do what he'd have to do if he were on stage. To a great extent, that just sort of works, right?
Yeah. Well, my question going into the film, and my first thing I would say is I have some of the same questions going into a movie like this that I did with when we talked about The Irishman, which is, this is a story that has been told a lot. This is a kind of person, the kind of the young, overwhelmed soldier. You know, that's kind of a favorite character of filmmaking and has been for a long time. So for me, I don't necessarily think this film is introducing a lot of kind of really new emotional beats. I think how dedicated they are to this mission that they have to do, how frightened they are for the people who they're hoping that they can help, you know, and then the sort of the relief at certain moments, the agony at certain moments, the loss that they suffer, the trauma that they suffer, they are kind of typical war movie beats. And that's why it was so important to me that it introduced something really interesting in the filmmaking. And yes, absolutely, I think the all one shot it's both a fascinating technical accomplishment, but also I think a really effective way to shoot this story. Because the question with something like this is always, is it a gimmick? Is it just there to be, you know, is it like the people who say, I wrote a whole story without using the letter E? Like, but why? Like, you know, but why? This, I think there is a reason,
right,
which is it's a mission story. It's a go from here to there. And the entire point of it is that you cannot stop and you cannot hesitate. It is one continuous journey, which is why shooting it as one continuous shot made sense to me.
Right. It also ratchets up the tension.
Absolutely. Yeah. And so I think there's a reason to do it. And I also think, as much as the technical accomplishment of the all one shot feel of it is impressive, I was just as impressed by the fact that you're constantly moving through space. Mm-hmm. So you're constantly in a new location from where you were 2 or 3 minutes ago. There's no doubling back.
Right.
There's very little stopping and waiting in one place, with the exception of a couple of times. There's very little pausing and waiting. The majority of this is on the move, you know, moving through. And as Bob said, you do see those moments where you think, this is where they made one of the cuts. But I did find after a while that I wasn't distracted by looking for those, which I was nervous that I would be. I ultimately found it very affecting and very effective, and it worked much better on me than I thought it might.
Well, and I think it's really tricky. World War I in particular is a war of just blunt force futility.
Yeah.
Like, there's so much of just, like, you're fighting for inches and you're just sitting there in this horrible stalemate, just pounding on each other, and everybody's dying. And how you manage to tell that story as more than just the futility
that,
of war,
yeah.
Creating a mission within that to try to save some of these people is kind of the only way you can tell this particular story. This isn't turning the tide of the war. This is just what one or two soldiers could do with the hand they're dealt.
Right.
Yeah.
You do become inured to it in a certain sense. I mean, yes, having the continuous shot thing happen, it's not like they put a ticking clock up in the upper right-hand corner, but they could have. I mean, that's kind of what they're doing. But what the technique does is for long stretches, the opposite of what's intended to do. It makes you look for the cuts. It makes you observe the artifice. It's supposed to make it this whole thing seem invisible, like it's one long thing. But I'm saying, in the beginning, I was looking for the cuts, and then there comes a time when it just disappears, mm-hmm. and then for the rest of the film, that becomes completely immaterial.
Yeah.
But there is that jump there. There's a little hump after like the 10-minute mark where all it becomes about trying to figure out how they're moving the camera.
Yeah, you're looking for the seams.
But think about how funny that is, because the real artifice, right, is in traditional film where you're changing points of view all the time. And, you know, Bob mentioned theater. One of the things that occurred to me was that staying with one point of view, even if it's moving around, has a similarity to theater. You're not mm-hmm. constantly going from, you know, it's weird. But we talked about with this with Cats, with the fact that
oh my God, that was the one similar movie I did not think you were going to mention.
Very similar films.
Okay.
Totally.
But we talked about how because they are constantly changing perspective and changing where you're looking, that was one of the things that created the feeling that the scale was constantly mm-hmm. changing, as opposed to theater, where you're looking at, you know, however big the cats are with regard to all the props and the sets, it stays the same. It mm-hmm. stays constant, right? Here, everything essentially stays constant because you're not switching point of view mm-hmm. all the time. So it doesn't, the funny thing is, in many ways, although it could be a gimmick, you could also look at it as the removal of the artifice switching from over here to over there, and now you're over this person's shoulder, and you know, now you're kind of having the fake feel of that.
Yeah, single shots go way back in film, and we used to think that the Fred Astaire, Ginger Rogers movies were amazing because when they shot a dance, you'd have a 6-minute sequence that was just the two of them dancing, and you didn't do all the trickery that is done in today's, in for instance, Cats, to disguise the fact that the people aren't really dancers or aren't as good as Fred Astaire.
Or even if they are dancers, for some reason, people feel the need to zuzz it up. Like, that's not a word, but you know what I'm talking about.
Well, and the other thing is that in a war movie, to ratchet up tension, the usual way to do that is to do a lot of quick cuts. You mm-hmm. shoot to the person who's shooting, you shoot back to the person who's a potential victim, you zip, 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 zip all over the place. And in this, if you eliminate that, Roger Deakins had to think of other things that he yes. could do to ratchet up the tension. And sometimes all he does is sort of make you say, oh.
I also noticed how, because it's being shot in that way, and so you don't have the editing changes, right, the pace mm-hmm. of the editing, you see all the other things that they're doing to create interest, to create kind of visual interest between one scene and another. They do a lot. I think this is one of the things that feels the least naturalistic to me, is some of the things that they do with light, particularly in one. There's one sequence where they're doing a lot with light to kind of give it a very specific, this is this sequence as opposed to the other sequences. Mm-hmm. They also do a tremendous amount with score, which goes anywhere. Cause score is anywhere from kind of a low hum to a very traditional kind of
orchestral,
war movie,
right.
orchestral stuff.
I'm glad you point out that score. Thomas Newman did the score. And I really expect that traditional kind of war movie grandeur. But like you said, Linda, there is that like Johan Johansson-y buzz through a bunch of scenes. It fuses together several different kinds of scores to tremendous effect.
Yeah, I liked it.
This is based on stories that Sam Mendes' mm-hmm. grandfather told him about his experiences in the war. Memory is supple, it's slippery, and it is often, not if it's not self-aggrandizing, it is flattering to oneself, right?
Well, and it's not an exact replica of the story that he was told, as I understand
But what
it
I'm saying is there might be a fully intentional, subtle Baron Munchausen, Big Fish kind of thing going on here, mm-hmm. where as it goes on, because what actually happens is in the opening minutes, somebody cuts their hand on barbed wire and you're like, oh my God, that's the worst thing I've ever seen in my life. And then later on, as the film is doing things are happening to these poor people, which don't have that same immediate visceral effect, because when you keep heightening, you also, in a sense, kind of lessen the tension.
Yeah.
You managed to skip the part where he cuts his hand on barbed wire and immediately accidentally plunges it into a corpse.
Yeah.
Not a spoiler. That's very early in the movie.
It's pretty intense. Stephen mentioned the phrase corpse bog. Yeah. And I did want to mention that one of the things I appreciated about the way they handle the violence of war in this film is that they are not as consumed with showing you people being killed. Mm-hmm. They are more consumed with the vision of the violence of war in this film is much more about the fact that these guys are traveling through an area where there's already been a tremendous amount of fighting and a tremendous amount of loss. Literally, there is a trail of dead bodies in the ground that they are covering. And I think it's very, this is the first war movie that I can remember that is less about the act of being killed and more about the accumulation of death in war. Mm-hmm. And I think when Stephen talks about the futility of World War One and that feeling that you're just grinding out this kind of everybody just, you know, killing each other in this very slow way, putting it where most of the dying that you are encountering on screen has already happened, I think is a very interesting way to approach the violence and death of war in a way that avoids the kind of classic, you can't show war without glorifying it because it looks glamorous in some way. Mm. There is some real gross stuff in this movie, but it's not exciting. It's just gross. And that's how I think war often
is. Let's talk briefly about a scene that is exciting, and that is in the trailer, so I'm not giving anything away. There is a scene that I was convinced had to have been done with digital manipulation, that there was no way that one of the characters would be running toward the camera with all of these other people running across him. And I just thought, Wait. He's got to be.
I thought about that.
It has to be digital.
I bet not.
Right? Well, there's a making of video that you can find on YouTube that shows that particular sequence. The choreography of that thing. Oh, my Lord.
Yeah.
And definitely see it in a theater for several reasons. One, the spectacle of it. But two, you will walk out of this theater and be discussing things with the people you see it with. A, where the cuts are. B, what was digital, what wasn't. C, you will be discussing the one big laugh line in this film that only works retroactively. And I'm not going to say anything more about it, but you'll know it when you come to it.
Well, and I would say, see it in the best circumstances that you can. But when we say see it in a theater, I'm always afraid it's going to make people think, if I miss it in a theater, is it just not worth it?
Right.
I don't agree with that. So I would say I definitely encourage people to seek it out. See it. It's very good. All right. Well, when you have a chance to finally see 1917, find us on Facebook at facebook.com/PCHH or tweet us at PCHH and tell us what you think. When we come back, it's going to be time to talk about what's making us happy this week. So come right back.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from Zoom. Zoom is used by millions to connect face-to-face across town or around the world. Zoom ties together all of your unified communication tools in one easy platform for video conferencing, phone calls, group chat, webinars, and conference rooms. Zoom is how business gets done. Visit Zoom online to set up your free account today. Meet happy with Zoom.
Welcome back to Pop Culture Happy Hour. It's time for our favorite segment of this week and every week. What's making us happy this week? Stephen Thompson, what is making you happy this week, buddy?
Well, it's a new year. I thought I would break out of my old rut, you know, my old comfort zones, recommend something that's, you know, completely fresh and unlikely coming from me. So I want to talk about a video where Justin Vernon from Bon Iver interviews Aaron Rodgers, the quarterback of the Green Bay Packers.
Oh, my God.
It is a 40-minute interview. You can find it on YouTube. It is held at Lambeau Field where the Packers play.
Are you sure you didn't dream this?
I cannot tell you when they announced this just how many people forwarded this to me. It is delightful. These are, among other things, two guys who clearly really like each other and are clearly fans of each other. It also is it's about the most Wisconsin thing you can do if you, like me, are a Wisconsin expat. It will take you back to many conversations that you've had, including there is a point in the interview where they debate whether an old bar is still open, which really is one of the most Wisconsin things that a person can do. So I enjoyed it enormously. It was put together by GQ Sports.
Sure.
As you might expect, it's terrific. Justin Vernon interviews Aaron Rodgers and vice versa.
Thank you very much, Stephen Thompson. Glenn Weldon, what is making you happy this week? I bet it's not something.
It ain't that.
Was that yours?
It was not. Oh, it took mine. Look, my another this thing has been out for weeks, so I'm sure listeners who are inclined toward liking it have already seen it. But just in case, on Christmas Eve, Netflix dropped a special called John Mulaney and the Sack Lunch Bunch. I don't envy the people involved in the pitch meeting for this thing because it doesn't slot easily into anything I've seen before. It is not a parody of 1970s children's programming, but it's not a parody of 1970s children's programming. John Mulaney is the host of the Sack Lunch Bunch, is a group of 11-year-olds who sing and dance and perform sketches that impart some life lessons. And at the heart of it is, what if 11-year-olds on TV talked and acted like 11-year-olds in real life and not like kids on the Disney Channel? The joke is how kids of that age seem like tiny adults. Not like precocious child actors. They're not cute, adorable, precocious. Kids say the darndest things. They are anxious and struggling and strongly opinionated about many things, including pop culture. Now, Faust and I watched it together, and it was clearly vibrating more on my frequency than it was on his, which surprised me. I'm not remotely a kid person, but this is not about the kids in a way. It's about the tone, which I cannot put my finger on. I loved it. John Mulaney and the Sack Lunch Bunch on Netflix.
Thank you very much, Glenn Weldon. Bob Mondello, what's making you happy this week?
One thing I'm happy about is that this is a time when I'm usually looking at the worst movies that are going to come out all year. January and February are always home to these just dreadful pictures.
Excuse me, Doolittle.
Case in point. So I haven't seen that yet. Maybe it's extraordinary. I do hope so. I am really keeping fingers crossed. But as a result, I have been rewatching absolutely everything in the queue on my television, just sort of cleansing from film. I'm now ready for something new, and there is something new, but sadly, it is the last season of the something new. It is Schitt's Creek.
Woo.
The show about the Rose family moves to a hotel that in a town that they bought as a joke back when they were wealthy, and they're now, I don't even know how to describe it. It's too much to describe. You should see it starting basically in season three, I think, which is when it got good, right? Yeah. I am so invested in these characters. Oh my God, I love them so much. And I am looking forward to settling down with them and sort of resting.
Yeah. And that's on Pop, right?
Right.
Yeah. And then you can catch up on Netflix on the old seasons, I believe. All right. Thank you very much, Bob Mondello. I know that's a favorite of a lot of our listeners. What is making me happy this week, you know, Netflix supposedly has a really good algorithm they pride themselves on that feeds you the things that you'll love. You can tell sometimes when their algorithm has failed. And it failed because it was only because of wonderful people on Twitter that I learned of The Repair Shop. They show it on Netflix. It's a British series. There are two seasons available. And it is an unscripted show in which a bunch of sort of artisans who repair clocks and toys and furniture and things like that work in a barn that it wouldn't normally all be one shop, but they set up this thing with all these different people. And then people bring in their beloved old things and then tell the sentimental story of why I love it and care about it. And then someone carefully restores the whole thing. What I love about it is it's the balance between the sentimental story of people saying, well, this was my grandmother's and then I broke it and now I feel terrible because I was meant to hand it down to my own children and it's broken and I want to be able to hand it down. But then also the technical side of how restoration is done. It is so restful. It is the most soothing, lovely. The people are really pleasant. It's like it has that Great British Bake Off, everyone is a nice person feeling to it. Very often, these are items that someone has actually used. It's not the kind of my Star Wars toy that's been in the original packaging for. This is my teddy bear that I've had since I was 3 years old. All the fur is worn off. There's a huge hole in it. The eyes came off, and then, you know, make it look new again, but not too new, right? And it's really a wonderful and great show. And I would not have found it without people on Twitter pointing me to it. So The Repair Shop on Netflix. Get yourself like a mug of tea. It is the most. And that is what is making me happy this week. Before we go, I do want to mention we've been asking you to donate to local stations for the last several weeks. And we had a link that we gave out. And we told you over and over again that one of the things we were doing was competing with the other podcasts.
Yeah.
And I do want to say you guys came through beautifully.
Yep.
Amazingly. Yes. We came in third, which, I mean, look, coming in first would have been great, but let's face it,
Out of all NPR podcasts, including some very, very, very popular daily shows.
Daily news shows. We came in third behind Up First, which is the wonderful first thing in the morning news show, mm-hmm. and the politics podcast, which, come on, man.
Come on.
Like, who can compete with politics news right now? What I'm saying is you guys overperformed massively. You punched above your weight.
Uh-huh.
It's a big help to public radio and stations, but it's also... it's good for us.
You've given us an excuse to gloat, which is really what it's all about.
Absolutely.
It's interesting. Like, we've kind of concocted a new emotion here where we are both gloating and thankful. I like to think that right now we're glanking.
Glankful. We're just so glankful for all of you for helping us help public radio and stick it to our colleagues.
I need a mug.
Thank you so much. We want a little plastic trophy. And that does bring us to the end of our show. You can find all of us on Twitter. You can find me at Linda Holmes, Stephen at I Dislike Stephen, Glenn at G.H. Weldon, and Bob at Bob_Mondello. And you can find our producer, Jessica Reedy, at Jessica_Reedy, and our producer emeritus and music director, Mike Katziff, at Mike Katziff, K-A-T-Z-I-F. Mike's band, Hello Come In, provides the music you are bobbing your head to right now. Thanks to all of you for being here.
Thank you.
Pleasure.
And thanks for listening to Pop Culture Happy Hour from NPR. If you have a minute and you're so inclined, please subscribe to our newsletter at npr.org/popculturenewsletter. I will say, if you subscribed to the newsletter, you would already know about the repair shop because I wrote about it last week. We will see you all right back here next week.
Wake up to a fresh take on the day's news with Up First every weekday morning and now Saturdays at 8 a.m. Eastern, too.
10 minutes is all you'll need to start your day informed. And now you can listen 6 days a week.
I'm Scott Simon.
And I'm Lulu Garcia-Navarro. Up First, to start your weekend from NPR News.